to The Cine Skinny, the podcast from the people behind The Skinny magazine. It's Jamie Dunn here again, and I'm still kicking around Glasgow Film Festival, which is nearing its end for 2024, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to catch up with a couple of fellow critics and friends of the pod to discuss what they've been watching at the festival. So joining me today is Karen Paddock. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Nice to be here.
And Rory Doherty.
Hello.
Hi, Rory.
Hi.
So, Karen, Rory, you'll be known to our listeners, I'm sure, but maybe you could do a quick introduction to tell us about yourself and where we'll see your writing.
Hi, I've been writing various reviews and film criticism for over a decade now, which is a bit scary. You can find my writing at The Skinny and Take One and in Movies We Texted About for the Glasgow Film Festival reviews.
Roy?
Hi, I'm a critic based in Edinburgh. You can find my festival writing at, it'll be at Dread Central and A Good Movie to Watch. You can also find me in Pace Magazine, Inverse, GQ, elsewhere.
Sounds good. And then, how has your Glasgow Film Festival experience been so far? What's the kind of general vibe of the festival this year? Have you been enjoying it? Have you been busy? What's going on?
I've had a slightly less busy festival than I have in previous years. As a sort of, I think, self-care, just trying to like turn the dial down on any festival that I'm kind of doing going forward. But it's certainly a terrific program. I think it's one of their strongest programs in quite a few years. It's a great mix of sort of really young voices, especially local ones, and films coming out in the next couple months, which would be good to get previews of, but also then just some of the most daring cinema of the last festivals of the last year. I think it's a really great look.
More importantly, what's your self care tips for festivals?
I need
them because I'm falling apart.
Well, I think the biggest thing I have is if you are in the city where the festival is, it is so much easier to burn yourself out. And it is so good if you have to get like a bus or a train or something, as I do, to come through to Glasgow, and relieving yourself of that, just going like, do I actually need to go and see this? Do I, like, regardless of when you can then catch the film in the future, it's also a good idea to just actively think about, do I want to spend time watching this film regardless of its merit? But also, just, I got a piece of advice at London by a very seasoned critic going, there's never any reason to watch more than 3 movies a day. And that's a really, I mean, if I'm at like a bigger festival where it's like, these are all world premieres and you kind of need to catch them all, then that's a different kettle of fish. But for festivals like Glasgow, you don't really need to see it more than like 3 or 4, I think. And walk around in the sunshine or with the fresh air and drink regular cups of tea and water.
It's good advice. Water is very good advice.
Yeah.
Karen? How's your festival week? And probably have your self-care tips if you have any.
I'm afraid I don't have any self-care tips. Living in Glasgow, I have definitely taken it a bit intense this year. Okay. I've tried to basically just max out and see everything I could. And I think part of the appeal of that was just how brilliant the programming has been this year. Like opening with Love Lies Bleeding, getting the UK premieres of La Chimera, Green Border. They've really picked the best of the best of festivals, kind of from last Cannes all the way through, actually from last Berlin with Disco Boy all the way through now, which is just fantastic. And it's really impressive to see the festival pulling, you know, all these stars and star power in. I've gone a bit mad on what I've seen. And if I'm not 100% coherent today, that's why. The sleep has not been the priority. So I think next year I might do a bit more of what Rory does.
My self-care tip, if you want to hear it, is see some of the old stuff. I think it's actually quite nice to go and see something that you actually don't have to review. Just see, like, see something really, you know, something that there's no kind of like commercial value in you seeing it. Just see it for fun. Mm-hmm. You know, don't see it for like potentially pitching it somewhere. So I know you guys were saying After Hours was a riot.
Yeah, After Hours was probably my most enjoyable screening so far. It's the new 4K print, which I think they did for the Criterion edition that's just come out. It's just such a terrific film. I think very upper echelons of Scorsese's work. I don't know, he gets a lot of flack for his 80s stuff because they were all a bit misfires, I think, commercially and or critically. But in a decade that I'm slowly learning was just the most like conservative conditions for creating art after the 70s and New Hollywood is from the 60s. I think his 80s career is one of the finest, like not in just his career, but that any sort of auteur had in that decade.
Yeah. It's also good for the people who say, oh, Martin Scorsese only makes one type of film, you know, makes gangster movies, because this is his weirdo 80s yuppie. Has One Night of the Soul in Soho.
Yeah, I think it's basically like it has the texture of a nightmare of a sort of Wall Street pen pushing kind of yuppie travels to Soho for what he thinks will be just like a casual night of sleeping with Rosanna Arquette, and basically gets trapped in a sort of seventh layer of hell. Kind of everyone's behavior is heightened. Every single option to getting out there and getting home, it sort of like folds in on him. And I genuinely reminded me so much of people I've met exclusively after 1 a.m. and the idea of like the thing most present on your mind is how to get out of this situation talking with these people, but also the weird vulnerability and the strange like really uncomfortable intimacy you get with people when you're inebriated or exhausted or somewhere you don't recognize. And then separately, the idea of trying to get somewhere and all these little things coalescing in a nonsensical way, but feels really mundane to stop you doing what you want to do, is like exactly how my dreams feel and many people's dreams feel. So it's genuinely, it was really confronting how much I related to the experience of After Hours.
Cameron, was there any of the older program that you've had a chance to see?
So the only one I've got to is After Hours.
As well.
And I'm hoping to get to Walk the Line on Sunday as part of their decade retrospectives, which I just think is great. You just turn up, get ticket if you're lucky, and see a film for free, which is just such a great offering for the city. And
well, I should say, actually, another place you can get your writing is the booklet that the Film Festival created, Our Story So Far. Maybe you can talk about that experience, you know, because you maybe talk about the films you wrote about.
Yeah, no, so I wrote about Wuthering Heights, which, and the 1939 film with Merle Oberon and Laurence Olivier, which screened last weekend, but it is on Amazon Prime if anyone has that, so you can still watch it. And I wrote about the fact that there's lots of readings of Wuthering Heights, especially today, seeing Heathcliff as a bit of an othered character. Maybe he's black, maybe he's of Indian origin. But then Merle Oberon was actually the actress who kind of had to hide her Indian heritage in Hollywood. So it's a bit of the meta level is different, but she was the first woman of Asian descent to be nominated for an Oscar, but then she was never nominated again after that. And so a lot of people think that maybe Hollywood considered her, you know, lauded enough, and now they just said that needed to give the white women the awards. But it is a good adaptation. Maybe it's a little bit more romantic than Bronte's novel. It might be a little bit sanitized, but it's gorgeous to look at and it sounds great. I think that the score is really good. It's got different themes for Cathy and Heathcliff. So definitely worth catching on Amazon Prime.
And you did Brick.
Right? I wrote on Brick. I think the motive with the retrospective screenings for Glasgow this year was like films from key dates in Glasgow cinema history, both in the festival, the GFT, like cinema, and older kind of like reckoning points. So yeah, I wrote on Brick, which came out the same year as the first Glasgow Film Festival. And it's wild because Rian Johnson's gone on to insane levels of popularity and status with his films. But I really, really enjoy just a sort of his riff on neo-noir and kind of like hard-boiled detectives, and it like the best sort of pastiche. It has like a really burning emotional story at the middle of it, and which helps ground you when you're doing a detective case that's like all set in a sort of, it's like Pasadena High School or something like that. But yeah, it's so we both had the opportunity to write a wee blurb write-up of the film, and they were all collated in a booklet which is available to pick up all across the festival.
Well, pick that up. You'll find it at GFF and other venues.
Mm-hmm.
But talking about neo-noir, we should probably talk about the opening film, Love Lies Bleeding. Now, this opened on the 28th, so it's been over a week, and I think I'm still vibrating from this movie. How did you feel? When did you watch it? Did you watch it on opening night, or did you see it in the press screening?
saw opening night. I was in GFT 2, so not the one with the live Q&A, but we had the Q&A kind of broadcast into it. But I think GFT 2 has the best sound of any of the screens, so I was happy to see it there. You've had great soundtrack.
Yeah, what were you doing?
Yeah, I saw the press screening a couple of days before, so it's like a way to kick off your day at like 10 o'clock in the morning. And yeah, it was a jolt of sort of energy. I think a lot of times with these kind of A24 thrillers or genre movies, I think there's a kind of reluctancy from me and other people, I think, because a lot of these sort of riffs on genre and horror and thriller and feel like they are doing their riff or making their commentary before actually delivering the thrills of the genre film. And what I liked so much about St. Maud and more so Love Lives Bleeding is it's very, very concerned with the commentary being not secondary to the thrills, but part of the thrills, basically. And Love Lives Bleeding is a queer sort of frontier Western body horror crime movie. And within all those layers is the sort of themes and messaging of and commentary on gender and violence and queerness, but really it is there to deliver the thrills, and I sort of respected it a lot for that.
Yeah, we should probably set it up. So it stars Kristen Stewart, who plays Lou. She's the manager of a grimy gym in this kind of dead end town in New Mexico. Lou's pretty curmudgeonly. Her days are filled with unclogging block toilets in the gym and dealing with her terrible family, who include a sister who's constantly being beat up by her horrible husband. The sister's played by Jenna Malone, who's great casting, I think. They're perfect as sisters. Dave Franco plays her dirtbag husband. Lou also has issues with her father, who's played by Ed Harris. He's wearing a terrible wig. I've never seen somebody who's bald and has a mullet at the same time. It's fantastic. But Lou's life has changed when Jackie walks into her gym. Jackie's this kind of sweet bodybuilder with a heart of gold. When these two get together, sparks fly. The film is very horny, very sexy. It's got a juicy crime plot. It's got some brutal murders. It's got some incredibly surprising moments, I think. Karen, what did you make of it?
I loved it. And kind of like what Rory was saying, I do think that the fun and the thrills and the plot beats were more important than any commentary on family, crime, queerness, America. It was all just like, let's see how far we can take this. And I've just forgot how nice it is to see Ed Harris in something. I think it's been a while since I've seen him pop up in things, and he's just got a really great presence, and I think he's going to be one of my favorite kind of screen villains of the year in this. And the fashion was fantastic. I really hope like this, if this brings back the 80s revival, let it be. So
yeah, I thought it was just a really impressive, like, stepping up from Rose Glass. I mean, I think St. Maud is a great film.
Oh, yeah.
But it feels, like, limited by its budget. And to see a filmmaker just so confidently step into a Hollywood production and make it from the get-go, from the very moment it starts, I thought, oh, my God, I'm in safe hands here. This filmmaker knows what they're doing. It was so slick, so funny. And then she deals with these kind of pulpy elements so well, Rory.
Yeah, I do think it's better than St. Maud. I mean, I was a bit cooler on it because I saw it when the movie came out, and by that time everyone had, throughout all the festivals, had sung its praises so much. But I do think that maybe it's limited by budget, but also by a debut filmmaker. I think there's a level of like carefulness to St. Maud, which is not really what you want for a transgressive kind of horror. I think that it's pushing of psychology and religion and stuff like that. It feels a little sort of like calculated. Whereas, you know, this is Love Lies Bleeding is a messy film, and it's all the better for that, because it embraces like bodily excretions and the surfaces of people's faces and arms. And and it's interesting talking about like Ed Harris, because a fault in that, I think, in it is that it is so concerned with the texture of this relationship that the actual crime plot as it goes on, it isn't really that well developed. I think actually Ed Harris is an incredibly passive character. He doesn't really do anything until he is this sort of like menacing threat. And I'm glad the film didn't go into the details of this is the trauma that happened in the family and this is how she feels about it, because all the exposition we need is kind of on Kristen Stewart's face and in her body language. But yeah, I think it's slightly more mood-driven than it is plot-driven, but the same is said for like some of the best kind of neo-noirs of the 80s, so I don't think that in itself is necessarily a flaw.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think because, I guess, we've seen so many stories like this, actually the story's not that important. It is all about the textures and all about this, like you said, like these amazing close-ups of skin and body. But I think what surprised me most is Rose Glass also throws in these elements of horror which you don't get in these noirs. Like these, it was just in the edges body horror, and I guess it comes from the bodybuilding aspect. You find something quite monstrous about bodybuilding, and it is kind of the idea of like changing your body to such an extreme way as sort of, I think, should be explored in sort of horror. I don't know why it hasn't, actually.
It is weird, and I mean, that you look at those people posing on stage and you're like, that's really extreme and bizarre. And then I think the film's kind of nastier elements, both in maybe less literal, more fantastical things, and then in actual literal things that happen, it's not afraid to really, to lean in to the nasty.
And I think what kind of pushed this over the line for me as a great, great film is, I don't want to spoil it, but there's something happens in the film which was so unexpected and comes from such a left field. But actually, when you think about it, it's kind of hinted at all the way through the film. I love a filmmaker who just swings and goes for it, you know, especially on this scale where I could see another filmmaker would sort of pull back and say, actually, this is a big risk. But yeah, a filmmaker just goes for it.
I think as well, that's perhaps why I had a bit more sort of faith with the big swing that happens. There's no swing bigger in the film than this sort of moment in the climax. And it's why I have a bit more sort of goodwill towards it and to Rose Glass, is because I don't think a moment like that would even have been dreamed up when she was making Saint Maud. You know, I feel like there's incredibly memorable moments and shocking moments in that film, but something is, I have no idea how this is going to be received, but I know it makes sense for me, the storyteller. I feel like that shows a real growth, and sort of it's really exciting to see in Love Lies Bleeding.
Although I was going to say, Saint Maud does have a moment at the end, which is very fantastical, you know, that like a lot of,
yeah, it is. I don't think it's a risk though, necessarily. Oh, yeah. Like, and the one in the its mirror in Love Lies Bleeding is like, this people could just switch off at this, and you know, gotta respect that.
She has a lot of faith in her audience, yes. I think, and I think that, like, you were saying, like, the whole backstory isn't fully explained. I think at the end as well, she knows she's created a world so believable and rich, and she has actors who play things with levels that means she doesn't have to expose everything in the script, which is great. I would love to see more of that.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably the best I've seen Kristen Stewart, I think. I think she's just so good at this kind of like moody... She's essentially, if it's a neo-noir, she's like the kind of James Cagney character. She's this kind of like moody character whose life is changed by this kind of femme fatale. And she is perfect in that role.
Stewart's incredible, I think, off the back of this and sort of like Crimes of the Future. You know, you're really getting a lot of texture and boldness from her performances. I think, was it Katie O'Brien who plays her partner, the bodybuilder, is also doing incredible work. I think it was mentioned by friends after seeing it that there's a lot of softness to her, to this bulking kind of figure, and a lot of shades of feminist and masculinity, or which is where you get a lot of the queer sort of like thoughts and messages of the film, is through this like really well observed and unusual performance.
Yeah, I think we can safely say that's a thumbs up. A very good way to kick off a festival. Another exciting element of the festival this year is we've had a bona fide Hollywood legend walking around Glasgow in Viggo Mortensen. He was here for his second film as a director, The Dead Don't Hurt. Yeah, was it exciting to see Aragorn wandering around? Did you get a glimpse of him? Did you go to any of the screens he was at?
I was at the Q&A screen of The Dead Don't Hurt, so I saw the film, and then he introduced it very briefly, and then he came out at the end to do a Q&A. And he seemed much ready to sit there all night and talk about it with people, but of course GFT were like, get out at some point.
So, and he had already done a Q&A about his career before that screening. Or was it the day before?
It was before that screening.
Yeah.
It was the
literally,
same day.
And I went to the second screening, the daytime one, expecting like, literally on a whim going like, I've got a free, I'm here and I'll see this. And then as a surprise, he came out at the start and then by the end decided to do a Q&A as well because he just couldn't get enough of
I think GFF were taken by surprise that he just turned up for a second. He was meant to, you know, he was only contractually obliged to do one, and again,
that's great.
But he also, as part of the retrospective, they added a history of violence screening in, and there was pictures were just posted on GFF page of him inspecting the 35mm print in reverence and sort of of it, which he seems to have had just an absolutely lovely time.
Yeah. I'm so happy for him.
Yeah, and happy for us as well.
Oh, same.
So a little bit about the film. It centres on a romance between Mortensen's character, who's Olsen, this kind of Danish carpenter. It's set, I should say, in, I think it's about 1860 in New Mexico. And he meets Vicky Creeps' character, who's Vivian, who's this kind of fiercely independent French-Canadian woman who has a kind of dream when she was a child of being Joan of Arc. And she's very kind of feisty and cool. And the film's got this kind of non-linear structure, which sex flashbacks to tell the story of Olsen and Vivian's life together. I think as actors, Mortensen and Creeps are kind of a match made in heaven. I think every scene with them together is really a joy. And they've got a great supporting cast. Danny Huston is this kind of slippery mayor. Garrett Dillahunt is this kind of tycoon who owns most of the town, this kind of little outpost. And one of the surprises was young Scottish actor Solly McLeod, who actually, I think, joined Vigo for one of the Q&As. But he plays this kind of brutish psychopath, who's this kind of loose cannon who could snap at any moment, and then his behaviour kind of intersects with Olsen and Vivian. You know, it's a film that's kind of like a homage to Westerns, but it's also, by the fact it's focused mainly on Creeps' character, I think it's also subversing this kind of macho genre in a way. Rory, maybe can start with you. What did you think of this one?
I really enjoyed the film. I mean, maybe it's impossible within the festival context to see it separately from the warmth that's surrounding, like, Viggo Mortensen's around the film. But I was mainly sort of won over by it by just how, like, it felt very much like an uncompromised story. It felt very much like when directors are like, this is the story I wanted to make. And it did feel like we were being invited into that world. The structure of it is sort of fractured, but like coherent, you know, with flashbacks and like figuring it out. And it does genuinely feel like there's a trust put in the audience to understand, to not have to explain down to them, but also be like, come with me. Like, this is how I want to tell the story. And I think this is how the emotions are best delivered in this order. And I think that works quite well. But especially after seeing his... I mean, has anyone else seen his opening film, Falling?
Falling, yeah.
It's not very good. And it's like, it's like I said, a drama with him and his Alzheimer's-suffering father, played by Lance Henriksen, who I'll watch in anything, you know. But it feels so much like the type of debut actors do, and then they never make another film. And so to not just see a much larger film for him, but one that feels much more unique in what actors do as films, you know, I was really warmed by that.
I'm going to say, I struggled a little bit with the non-linear aspect. I just found it quite confusing, but in a nice way, actually, because it opens with such a startling image. It opens with this knight on a... You know, you're sat down ready for a Western, you know, you're ready for Ford's Hawks, but it opens with this knight who turns out to be Joan of Arc, and we realise later that this is Vivian's sort of fantasy of herself, which is really interesting. So it's filled with these kind of strange... As much as it's a classic Western, it is quite strange to have that kind of avant-garde structure. Carmen, how did you find it?
Yeah, I think kind of like Rory was saying, and like Love, Life, Bleeding, I think like this was a film that had a lot of faith in its audience, and I found the storytelling did make sense kind of emotionally, and it wasn't like, sometimes it'd be a bit of a shift, oh, we're in this kind of timeline now, but it never, I never felt like any scenes were confused within that, and I think it was a story Viggo wanted to tell. It did feel very old-fashioned in both a good way and a bad way. Like, this, if you'd taken... Perhaps the Joan of Arc element was a bit of a new genre addition, but if you took the basic bones of the story and said that this was a film made and set in the 1950s, I would have kind of bought it. I think, I don't think I was quite as warm on maybe some of the more regressive elements of it. I feel like they wanted to center Vivian, but they were just like, also like, let's see how much we can put her through in it. And I was like, I don't know if this is adding anything to the genre, but it's great. And everyone's acting well and committing to it. But yeah. I'm on the fence.
I can definitely see that point of view. I think what maybe I probably could agree with it, but I think just Vicky Creeps is just so good.
She's so good.
She's just fantastic. And I think everything she's done has been good, but she's particularly good here. It is a kind of interesting character in that, I mean, I don't want to spoil any of the film, but something horrible happens to her.
Mm.
A couple of horrible things, actually. And she deals with it with such dignity and such strength without being a kind of cliche of like femininity on screen, you know, like, you know, she's not like a Sharon Stone in that kind of Sam Raimi film, you know, like she doesn't pick up a gun and become a gunslinger. She within the bounds of the Western and you know, her position in this world, she deals with it in such an interesting way, in such a kind of noble way. But I just think her presence was great, and her chemistry with Viggo Mortensen was really lovely. And I think actually I would have, if I was going to say anything, I would say maybe it should have taken out some of the more Western elements, maybe been more of a romance. I would have loved to have seen a kind of just a simply romantic Western with these two characters at the start, because I think it's strongest when they're both on screen together.
I think what's interesting as well is that, you know, yes, the film is very concerned with the ways that the West and as America was pushing forward in its history. I mean, the Civil War happens off screen during the movie. And it's concerned with the ways that the woman's role in America was incredibly limiting and regressive and punishing. But also what I liked was, as we see with that interplay with her and Viggo, we see that the male's the role of men in the society was also completely faulty. You know, that there was no way within the story, you get the feeling that there is a lapse in protection, because if your entire society is structured by the man provides and protects the woman, but also says the man is independent, has an ideology, wants to, you know, make his own identity in the West, you see that there's a massive lapse there. And so when Olsen does have that, you know, he joins up to fight with the Yankees in the Civil War, because as a sort of expat who's experienced a kind of from Denmark and experienced war there, he feels like this is going to like actually solidify his identity in this massive changing place. And there's this huge sort of gulf left in with his relationship and his family, and because he has just prioritized one, and there's no room to actually consider that if you are favored by having more security than your wife, then you do need to put in as much work as possible to shore up that like safety. And that, and then when they're, and later on in the film, in their later stretches of the relationship, that's where I think some of the most interesting stuff comes from between them. We've seen them sort of fall very, you know, tactilely in love, and then towards the end we just have this sort of big distance between them, which is really compelling.
I think it's also a little bit of an immigrant story as well. You know, Viggo's kind of an interesting character because he was born in America, but actually he grew up in Denmark, and I think he grew up in South America. Mm-hmm. So I feel like he's bringing in that element as well, this idea of not being from a place but feeling like you belong there. So there's an interesting line where Olsen says to Vivian, "Oh, you're French." He says, "No, I'm not French." You know, but he jokes that he sounds French. And then obviously he's this Danish character who has no reason to sort of feel any affinity to America, but he goes off and fights in these wars. So I think it's also saying something about belonging and sort of,
you know. Very similar to Aragorn as well.
So we're a little bit mixed, but I found it very kind of solid Western, but good filmmaking, great performances. But it did confuse me. That's probably because I watched it at half 8 in the morning and hadn't had my...
I'm happy for Viggo, mainly.
Me too. Yeah, he seems like he's had a great time. And he got to spend a lot of time with horses, and I understand that's what he really likes to do.
Horses.
So, and there were some great horses in the film.
Very good-looking horses, yeah.
And very good-looking scenery and location shoots. So, yeah, like, beautiful film to see on a big screen.
Is that two New Mexico films, then, in a row that we've covered?
The other one's Nevada.
Oh, Nevada. Sorry.
Oh, sorry, this is Nevada.
This is Nevada.
Did I say New Mexico?
You said New Mexico.
Oh, sorry, I meant I've got mixed up. Yes, this one's set in Nevada. But, you know, they're pretty, they're neighbors.
Oh, they're near. We say popped, you know. The distance, like the characters travel in the film is more than I have done to get here. Like.
So the final thing, the film I wanted to talk about was The Beast, which is the latest film for French auteur Bertrand Bonello, who is incredibly prolific and a kind of cult figure on the international festival circuit. But I don't think he's really had a film that's taken off in the UK, but maybe Beast will be that one. It's based on Henry James's novel, The Beast of the Jungle, or it's actually more of a short story, which is about a man who has this kind of existential fear of some catastrophe or some event that's going to happen to him. And because of this, it kind of like nullifies him. He can't move on with life. So in the film, Bonello's gender swapped it. Lea Seydoux plays Gabriel. She's the person with this fear of the beast that's going to destroy her. And the film is quite complicated to explain. It takes place in 2044, where Gabriel lives in this world run by artificial intelligence, who have a sort of Buddhist theory where we have these past lives and human emotion has been controlled because of this. Gabrielle is someone whose emotions aren't under control, however, so she has to go through this strange process of lying in a black bath of slime and living kind of past lives to clean up her DNA so she can be a kind of fairly functioning member of society or something. I think that's how it went. She begins going through this process, which takes her to encounters with George Mackay's character, Louis. So they flash back to Paris and 1910. There's also sections set in America, in LA in 2014. So it's a really strange brew. Each time period has its own tone. You know, the Paris section is very much feels like a kind of classic romance. The LA section is like a satire of LA and also a kind of horror film. It's very unsettling. And then obviously the 2044 part is very kind of dystopian sci-fi. Very strange film. I found it incredibly compelling. Carmen, what was your feeling?
I found it very exhausting. I appreciated the performances. I think unlike The Dead Don't Hurt, I did find myself quite confused with the time jumps. While I think Glasgow Film Theatre has an amazing sound system, I think the sound in this film is very aggressive and almost in an off-putting way that kept you on the edge of your seat so much that I almost couldn't engage with the kind of philosophical, theoretical, thematic stuff going on because I was just like, oh God, what's going to happen to my ears next? Lea Seydoux and George Mackay are great. I think they do a very good job keeping a through line for their characters, even though at first it takes a while for you to figure out how they're all kind of related with the past lives. But they have that feeling going through that in their relationships and interactions. And I mean, George Mackay speaks French and then talks with a very good American accent, so very good work by him. Yeah, I'm sure I'll probably come around, like I'll probably keep rethinking it, but I think I just was so pleased to get out into the fresh air after watching that. So yeah, it's bold, it's big, just maybe, yeah, go in kind of fortified. So
yeah, so we're talking about Rose Glass like swinging for the fences. I think Bonello's doing exactly the same. Rory, what do you think?
Oh, so I really like the film, but I will couch it with saying it took me two attempts to watch, because we were in Venice. It was like 8:30 in the morning where I first tried to see it, and our vaporetto was late because everyone was trying to get to David Fincher's The Killer, and I came into The Beast late, so I had already started, so that was put me off. And then the next like 30 minutes happened and I was like falling asleep, and I was like, I'll get this at some other point, and just sat and had like a coffee or something. So then I came back next time I had an opportunity to see it, and it is like, Carmen's absolutely correct in the emotional effect this movie has on you. It's kind of stultifying and weird and disarming. And then separate to my emotional experience watching it, it started to win me over, and I think it did start to compel me. I think the idea of it's my first Bonello film, so I have no idea what he's like, but he seems like a pleasant enough fellow. But the idea sort of hooked into me, this idea of humans have if humans have like nothing to do in nothing stimulating or exciting to do in a world run by AI, and they have like these kind of like menial mundane jobs of just like watching over the big computer, and the idea of, well, the humans are having existential angst, and the way we are going to address this is by going into having technology to go into their past lives and like completely numbing their like vibrancy, beauty, conflict, tension, all that kind of stuff, and so it won't be a problem to them. And it's an astute sort of observation, and it's a great way to look into these sort of like mirrored kind of past lives and multiversal kind of characters. And I think what's really nice about the film is that they all sort of lead towards these huge kind of crises and these huge like terrifying events, and I say as the lights just switch off, but especially when we get into LA, I think the LA sequence, which is kind of riffing a lot of sort of these big, vapid, empty homes and the actual kind of like night stalker, Zodiac killer, like fears of serial killers. And also through that, you've got a kind of Elliot Rodgers sort of men's rights activist, incel kind of stuff, which is, you know, just throw that in. What I think I like about that sequence and that whole arc of the film is that it wouldn't have got the same emotional whiplash and sort of disorientation had I not spent about an hour in, you know, early like France, like a couple centuries ago. So I, and then by the time it ended, I was like, nice, that's, you work, I think. But I entirely agree that the emotional experience of watching the film is can be quite punishing.
I think came out then loving this. I think Pinello does sort of, what's the word? He kind of like, certainly, he doesn't paint America in a nice light. After, you know, the film opens in France and in Paris, and it's like everybody's like wandering around talking about Madame Butterfly and, you know, looking at beautiful art, and it's all very kind of serene and beautiful. And then in America, everyone's want to have plastic surgery and everybody's awful, and this horrible incel sort of character is at the heart of it. But if taking that out, I just found the middle section so compelling. This kind of home invasion horror was so unsettling. I thought George Mackay is really good at, I mean, I think both characters are great, both actors are great, at least C.S. is always fantastic, and she's the kind of heart of the film, she's the main protagonist. But George Mackay has to be this kind of sweet Englishman who's struggling at French, and this crazy American who wants to murder everyone because he can't have sex, and then this real French person in the future. And he pulls it all off fantastically. I thought that idea of this beast was a very intriguing metaphor, you know, because you can take literally this kind of fear of catastrophe, but it's also a bit fear of love and intimacy in all the characters. And then there's these kind of weird sort of environmental catastrophes that come in. So in 1910 Paris, the city floods. Or in LA, everybody's scared about the big earthquake that's going to come. So these kind of ideas of catastrophe is something that actually Bonello is interested in. But I think he's really kind of crystallised it here. I do want to see it again because I don't think I got everything out of it. It's a film that I think you have to bring a lot to it. You know, it doesn't spoon feed you all these metaphors. You have to like a lot of this is I'm just a lot of guesswork, but I kind of enjoy that type of film.
I think I will give it another go at some point. Maybe want to know kind of what to expect. And I will say it's the most nightmarish version of LA or of anywhere that insists that Léa Seydoux needs plastic surgery. I mean, what are you talking about? She's one of the most beautiful women in the world. And I thought there was some really good humor kind of woven in throughout. Like a bit with a vase was very, very good. And I thought some of the film effects, like almost the, instead of the world moving in a way, the camera, the lens would almost fray. I did think that was quite neat, but I was exhausted.
I did watch it on my laptop, and I was just convinced my Wi-Fi wasn't working. So there's a few times where I thought, okay, this is broken.
Doesn't it also end with a QR code instead of credits?
Which was hilarious.
Yeah. You just like you can scan a QR code and go and see the credits, and I was like, that's good. I like that. But I have as much as I like the film, I have watched it. I have tried to watch it twice now, so I think I'm going to leave it for the future.
Well, I'm going to try again. And I just think it's a really, it's one of the first really good films on AI, I think. I think we're going to see more of these. And it, you know, quite pressing, because I presume it was made long before the actor strikes and stuff. So, yeah, Bonello's got his fingers on the pulse, I think. Okay, to wrap up, maybe we could talk some of our highlights, other films that you want to shout out to that we haven't mentioned yet.
I'll chat some of the European ones that I love in the programme. Glasgow, I caught up with the other international Oscar nominees, or international film nominees that aren't out. So Germany's The Teacher's Lounge and Italy's Io Capitano, which are Teacher's Lounge I thought was good, but I'm ultimately a bit constructed. And then Io Capitano is actually a kind of bolder take on a refugee sort of story that I thought was really moving. But then I also, the bigger highlights, I think, for me would be the Agnieszka Holland Polish asylum seeker film Green Border, which is incredibly visceral and intense and moving. And she's like in her 70s pulling off these 2.5 hour odysseys of incredible grit and basically like brutal filmmaking. So I love that. Radu Jude's Do Not Expect Much from the End of the World is a complete nightmare and exhausting in the good way, because it's a movie about gig economy and effectively a failed state kind of situation going on in Romania's capitalist kind of enterprise. And that's really audacious and feels like we're overlooking like someone's editing bay a lot of the times as they like do some experimental sort of changes of camera. And then I finally, what else I really like that was in the program? I've completely forgotten it now, but there was one. Oh no, La Chimera, of course. Okay. Alice Rohrwacher's Etruscan cave diving grief drama, which is just splendid.
Cave diving?
Oh, cave scavenging. Oh, grave robbing.
Grave robbing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, Ian, they're caves. Anything's a cave if you try hard enough.
You just move them. Right?
Oh, yeah. Sure, yeah.
Carmen, what about yourself?
I've got to also shout out La Chimera, Green Border, Io Capitano. They're all splendid films. I think La Chimera might be my film of the year. I know it is March 8th, but I'm comfortable calling that now. It's just magnificent. It's melancholic. Josh O'Connor's... Again, like George Mackay is acting in two languages and just absolutely shattering your heart. I found Green Border just one of the tensest and most upsetting films I've ever seen. Mm. And the fact that Holland has like burned all her bridges with the Polish film industry to make this, I just respect her so much. And I won't spoil. I think kind of like some other films we've talked about, it works in chapters and follows different storylines very coherently. I will say I don't think I've been as mad at anything as its epilogue. We'll just leave that there. And I think for the new film, I saw Sometimes I Think About Dying last night, which the volunteers on the door just had to clarify. This is the name of the film, not how we're feeling right now, when we went in to see that. And it has Sundance written all over it. It's kind of mid-budget American, few locations shoot, very low-key acting. But I thought it was just really lovely, and Daisy Ridley is actually really good, so that it was Star Wars' fault, not her fault, that things happened. And it's just about a woman working a really dead-end office job, and it kind of takes a while for you to figure out what decade it's in. Eventually you see a Slack icon and you're like, oh, this is now. But it's just so monochrome, and just she just keeps thinking about like, what if I was in a forest covered in bugs dying, what if I was like on a beach washed up dying, and then slowly her kind of bubble gets burst. But it wasn't about her joining, kind of learning how to be a normal human. It's kind of her, like, everyone's a bit weird, I think, is what the film was going on. And yeah, so super Sundance, but it made me happy. So
sounds good. I would echo a lot of those films. I think one that I wanted to shout out was Horde, which is interestingly a film that I've just heard terrible things about from other critics, and I was blown away by this filmmaker, Luna Cameron. Have you? Weirdly, the few people I've talked to about didn't like it. They felt
That's a bad film. Sorry.
Okay, well, there you go. Here we go. You weren't even the person I was thinking about. I can see why they don't like it. It's tonally very how's the word? It's another film that swings a lot, and it's tonally, it is all over the place. It's very messy filmmaking, but I think very powerful, very visceral. It's similar to Rose Glass in the way it's very in tune with like textures and fluids. Just very sensual in its filmmaking. And yeah, I was bowled over by the performances. It centers a young woman whose name I haven't written down, but she's fantastic. It's basically about a young girl who it starts, I think, in the mid 80s with a young girl who lives with her mother, who's a hoarder. And she lives in a house of chaos and mess and filth, but it's actually also a lovely environment as well. The mum tries her best and she treats her really well until something happens and the kid has to go to foster home. Then it cuts 10 years later and we find her living in foster home. She's very happy. She seems to be very well adjusted. The foster home is lovely. The foster mother is lovely. Everything's going well. But then she starts to take on some of her mother's hoarding sort of mental illness when a man comes in and sort of... It's partly sexual awakening, but it's also partly... like trauma coming back to her sort of grief sort of that's been withheld. I thought it was very powerful. I think Luna Cameron is a born filmmaker. It's just like so visceral and so shocking, and I can see why someone might hate it, Rory.
Oh sure, yeah, but like it's for me it felt very amateurish and overwrought, and I think it actually summarizes why a lot of British film is like we shouldn't just be turning towards giving everyone an exciting new debut, basically, because it feels very sort of like incomplete to me. But sure,
I could not disagree more. It is overwrought, and I think actually it's really cool to see a British film that goes for like big emotions. You know, I think sometimes in Britain we can be a little bit uptight, you know, and like I feel like if you look back at films from the 70s, you know, they are over, like Ken Russell or, you know, Peter Greenaway, you know, these filmmakers used to make kind of quite wild films. And I think over the years, British cinema has changed and become a bit more kind of subdued and realist. But I think Luna Cameron has a style which actually is quite grounded and has characters who are very authentic. But then she just has like these kind of wild flights of fantasy. So it's a winner for me. Please go along and see it when it comes out and tell me if you agree with me or you agree with Rory.
I'll break the tie at some point.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's us, guys. I think we'll meet a podcast. Anything else to say before we leave this place?
Stay safe.
Stay safe. Drink loads of water.
Drink loads of water. That's how you stay safe.
Yeah. Sleep.
Sleep.
Yeah. Eat your vegetables.
For God's sake, look after yourself.
Yeah. So for more information on what's on at Glasgow Film Festival, head to theskinny.co.uk/film. You can read some of Cameron's amazing reviews. And Rory, where can we see your reviews?
You can see my reviews at Dread Central and A Good Movie to Watch.
Head there as well. Although, go to the Skinny first. Give us the traffic as well. That's all from us, guys. We've had a fun Glasgow Film Festival. Hope you have too. See you later. Bye. Say bye.
Bye.
Bye.